Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome back. This is Central Line, and I'm your editor and host, Dr. Adam Stryker. Today, we're welcoming Dr. Sarah Robertson to the show. Dr. Robertson is a pediatric anesthesiologist and a member of the ACE editorial board. She contributed an item on the topic of pediatric pain scales to the 19B issue. And pediatric pain scales is the topic of today's show. Dr. Robertson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start having you tell us a little bit about your background and your role with ACE.
Sure. So I am an associate professor of anesthesiology at University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist and just do peds, so 100% pediatric practice. I actually grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. I did my medical school training also here at the university and then went to the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences for my residency and Arkansas Children's Hospital for my peds anesthesia fellowship. We then went to Cleveland, Ohio for 1 year for my husband. We actually couples matched in anesthesia, and then he did a fellowship in Cleveland. I was at Rainbow Babies, part of Case Western, for 1 year, which was an excellent experience, and then decided to come back home in 2016, and we have both been staff at the university since then. We have a lovely daughter, two-year-old daughter named Lucy, who's the light of our lives, and we love her so much. I serve as the assistant program director for the Pediatric Anesthesia Fellowship, the Clinical Competency Committee Chair for the residency, and then also I'm the editor of our departmental newsletter, The Pulse, which I truly enjoy. I love my job. I love training our trainees and being able to experience anesthesia through their eyes and to teach them lots of good tricks and tips for peds anesthesia. I've always loved ACE. I have read every single issue that has come out. And I really jumped at the chance to join the editorial board. I'm currently in my second year of doing that.
Fantastic. ACE is a great program. I know a lot of anesthesiologists that not only really enjoy it, but rely on it actually for a lot of the CME.
Yeah, 30 hours of CME per booklet comes out twice a year. So that is a pretty significant amount.
Well, tell us a little bit about your involvement with a pediatric pain. Is this something that you just have taken a liking to? Is this something that you've made part a focus of your career?
So we currently have 12 pediatric anesthesiologists, and there's several of us that are on the pediatric pain team. I'm actually not one of them, but we do, all of us participate in regional and neuroaxial blocks in the operating room. And then we have a team that takes care of the acute pain service and the chronic pain service as well. So one of the parts of my practice that I really do enjoy is making sure that the children are safe and comfortable.
Before we get into some of the specifics of acute pain management or chronic pain management in children, why don't we start off the discussion by telling our listeners why we should be concerned here? What are the long-term adverse consequences of not treating pain in pediatric patients?
So kind of like as a little bit of a background, for a long time, we really have not known much about pain and pain perception in our very small patients. Only in the last couple of decades have we really shown that most of the neural pathways that conduct nociception from the periphery through the central nervous system are present and actually functional at 24 weeks gestational age, which is kind of amazing. Although those central connections, particularly the ones in the thalamocortical pathways, are involved in the integration and perception of conscious pain, those are not well developed. So basically the inhibitory descending pathways are immature in those little children. Some of the things that I came across while I was reading shown hospitalized infants born between 25 and 42 weeks gestation actually experience on average about 14 painful procedures a day during the first 2 weeks of life. So that can range from an IV stick to heel stick to putting a blood pressure cuff on, stuff that we don't really think of as painful could potentially be painful for these little people. So lots of long-term adverse consequences that also include some harmful neuroendocrine responses. So by 26 weeks, they will respond to tissue injury or inflammation with withdrawal reflexes, autonomic arousal, and also hormonal and metabolic stress responses. They can have disrupted eating, sleeping cycles. And then also another thing that has been discovered in the very recent time period is that they have an increased pain perception. So almost like a hyperalgesia or allodynia response, a repeated noxious stimuli may actually result in a heightened sensitivity to that nociceptive input, and then that would have adverse consequences for them, including central sensitization, almost kind of like a rewiring of their central nervous system, which is quite frightening.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about it, about back in the day, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they used to just do surgery on little neonates and not give them anything, or may give them paralytic and not give them any pain medicine. It's just hurts your heart.
Nope, that's what, yeah, we were told the same thing when we were trainees on the pediatrics, that was a fairly new development, was the idea of treating pain in younger patients. Why do you, just out of curiosity, why do you think that was the case? Why was there such a resistance to treating pain medicine? Or maybe why was there not a lot of emphasis on it?
So the responses that we see in term neonates, so facial grimacing and withdrawal and the physiologic changes, so increase in heart rate, increase in blood pressure, they happen in preterm children, but it's to a smaller degree of magnitude as the gestational age decreases. So people may not have realized that these neonates were actually in quite a bit of pain just based on their vital signs or the way they were acting towards the noxious stimuli. So I think a large part of it has to do with just the fact that we didn't know. We didn't know that, you know, they were in pain, or we were afraid, you know, to give them too much. And then, they stopped breathing, or we would have difficulty intubating, that kind of thing. So I think the best interests were at heart, but we just didn't know, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to ask about how much you feel like the apnea aspect of everything played into it,
right,
which was right. Always a focus in pediatric anesthesia, with the idea of having at least in the infants, having them breathe after anesthesia.
Right. Well, too, I mean, think about it. Pulse ox has only been around, since like the late 80s?
Yeah.
And so pediatric anesthesia wasn't really a thing. And a lot of these children were not surviving to, you know, to a certain point. So I think a lot of it had to do with we just purely didn't know what we didn't know.
And it's fair to say now, though, not only are we cognizant of it, not only are we as a specialty more aggressive at treating it, but it's evolved quite a bit. Techniques, modalities, everything, right?
I think the neonatal cases are some of the most fun, especially for the trainees, too, because they realize when you go in, especially if you're doing a bedside case, we will give a massive amount of fentanyl. It's so cardiac stable. It's almost like a fentanyl rock uranium anesthetic. And they do fantastic. I mean, their blood pressure is just most of the time rock solid, as long as you keep them, you know, hydrated and the blood appropriately given.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how we navigate the challenges of understanding pain in infants and interpreting it. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between small children, infants, as opposed to adults.
Okay. So it's kind of hard. It appears difficult to distinguish consequences of pain per se from the consequences of like other factors like prematurity, critical illness, deprivation of tactile and social contact, and then also nutritional deprivation. Because a lot of these kids, you know, if they have neck or something similar, they'll be on TPN and lipids, you know, and they won't be actually able to consume breast milk or formula. So, you know, that we really want to err on the, I guess, the side of caution and give the pain medicine. Don't withhold analgesia, I guess, from the little bitty babies. So with older children who also have other comorbidities, it's really hard sometimes to distinguish pain from hunger, pain from wanting their caregiver. So a lot of the times I'll ask the parents before surgery, especially if the child does have delays or other comorbidities that'll make it very difficult for me to tell if they're in pain, how their child responds to pain normally awake. And that gives me a good idea, especially in the recovery room after surgery, on how to best treat their pain, is how they respond to what the caregiver tells me is what they normally, how they normally respond.
It's a great suggestion and a great segue into talking about some specifics. What are things that are commonly seen as indicators of pain in the younger population?
Right. So the younger population, the facial grimacing, my number one. So I'm going to go to the bedside and, you know, do a quick physical exam. But facial expression for me is the number one. There are lots of children who cannot verbalize, who cannot say, you know, I'm in pain, or tell me where the pain is coming from. But a cry, like crying in general, again, it's hard to distinguish that from possibly being hungry, especially if they've been MPO all day. Also body posture, so legs to the chest, motor restlessness, moving around, like not being able to keep still because of discomfort. are the main things that I look at and are pretty reliable indicators of smaller children being in pain.
Let's say you're a community anesthesiologist, you take care of all sorts of age groups of patients, and you know, you may not be taking care of the smallest ones all the time.
Right.
What would you recommend to those anesthesiologists when it comes to treating pain, let's say after an anesthetic in an infant? Let's say they're awake, you're not sure, you don't want to give too much. Is it better to maybe err on the cautious side and give a little more than you might otherwise give, or is it better to withhold it and not take the side effects of giving the medication? I know it's a tough question. It's very general.
Well, it is a tough question. Obviously, it has to be taken case by case. But if you're going to the bedside and evaluating the patient, I usually, for my PACU orders, will write, and unless there's a contraindication for morphine, I find it's long acting. It will, especially if the patient's going to be outpatient and going home, they tend to do really, really well for longer time period as far as pain control goes with that. I practice, obviously, in an academic center. We happen to be the only children's hospital in the whole state. So some of these patients can be traveling 2-3 hours home. And so you want to make sure that they don't get halfway home and are like just dying of pain. So morphine is my go-to. I usually do 0.05 milligrams per kilogram to 0.1. And it really honestly just depends on the child. Also, you know, everybody says multimodal pain control, fantastic. So we use IV Tylenol. Unfortunately, in our institution, we're actually only allowed to use that for tonsils or adenoids. We occasionally slip it in otherwise, but Toradol is actually also one of our go-to medications. Of course, you know, the GFR does not reach adult levels till about 2 years of age. So I always teach our residents, you know, we try not to give it in a kid less than 2. And I actually max out at about 15 milligrams per kilogram. I think there was a recent paper, I think in the last 5 years or so, that basically said there's really no difference between giving 15 milligrams and 30 milligrams. Even though the dose is 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. And I've really found that to be true. But we utilize Toradol very heavily in the pediatric population, just kind of depending on the surgery itself and the surgeon preference too. Sometimes the surgeons don't want us to use it because of blood loss. But those are our go-to meds for the postoperative pain control for kids. And that's it.
You mean 15 milligrams total, not 50?
Yeah, 15 milligrams total. Yeah.
Right. I'd seen that too. We had historically used up to 30.
Right.
And then recently that's shifted.
Well, and of course they package it in 60.
Right.
Always gets me. I'm like, I can only use a fourth of the bottle, but anyway.
Well, let's talk about some pain scales. There's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. This is obviously a valuable tool for children because they may lack the cognitive skills to quantify their pain. Let's go through some of them and what the advantages or disadvantages are.
Sure. So self-report metrics are those that the patient is asked to quantify the severity of the pain. So 0 being no pain, 10 being maximum pain. The child has to have cognitive skills, like to have the concept of magnitude and order to do this. So those scales are not typically used until about 7 years of age, but can be used down to about 3 years of age. So the most common and the one that the question, the ACE question focuses on is the Wong-Baker faces scale. It's from 0 to 10 and it has a cartoon faces of basically 0 being the least amount of pain and 10 being the maximum amount. And they're crying at the 10. There's also another faces scale called the Oucher faces scale, and it actually comes in multiple different ethnic offerings. So there's a African-American one, there's an Asian child, and then also a Caucasian child as well. So the patient can feel seen when telling the nurse or the physician at the bedside what is their pain. There's also numeric pain scales. So you can have the numerical self-report, the horizontal visual analog scale, and there's also a vertical visual analog scale. Those are the reporting scales. But there's also kind of going into the other types of scales, going on to the next question, is the observational and behavioral pain scale. So actually 5 behaviors have been shown to be more reliable and specific and sensitive, which are facial expression, vocalization, cry, leg posture, and motor restlessness. And we can kind of go into a couple of those. There's like probably 20 to 25 of these that are used. But the most common are the FLAC pain scale. And then also the CRIES pain scale. Both of those are used for postoperative pain assessment.
What do you think would be the most valuable for most of our listeners if there were a couple to choose?
Yes. So I think the most commonly used is the FLAC score. So that stands for face, legs, activity, cry, and consolability. Each category is scaled 0 to 2 with a total score of 10. So 0 would be like relaxed and comfortable. 1 to 3 would be mild discomfort, 4 to 6 moderate, and 7 to 10 severe. So at about the 4 scale, you're thinking about possibly giving some medicine for the patient's pain. This is an awesome scale because it can be used from about 2 months of age all the way up to about 7 years of age. So it's multi-use, wide range of ages as well. In contrast, the Wong-Baker Faces scale can be used, like I said, about 3 years of age, but that one can be used all the way up to about 18 years of age. The CRIES neonatal pain scale, that's used for the neonate. So from about 32 weeks to 56 weeks, it stands for crying, requires oxygen, increased vital signs, expression, and sleeplessness. And 0 to 2 each category is total score of 10, kind of exactly like the FLAC. I really do like the FLAC in addition, not only because it's multi-use and can be used for a wide age range, but they also have a modified FLAC scale for the cognitively impaired. So it's you can use it for pretty much anybody that you come across in the pediatric PACU. I also want to mention the CHEOPS, the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario pain scale. It can be used for children 1 to 7, and a score greater than 6 indicates pain. And then the comfort scale is actually used in the ICU setting. It has an insane amount of categories, up to 10. And then the 8 is the lowest score you can get, which is like deep sedation. And then 40 is alert and agitated, so alert and awake. Patient can be even intubated on a ventilator. You can get a pain score from that.
I want to talk about one pain scale we haven't touched on yet. Before we get to that, let's go ahead and take a short patient safety break. Please stay with us.
Hi, this is Dr. Alex Arriaga with the ASA Patient Safety Editorial Board. Medication errors are not uncommon in healthcare systems. In the field of anesthesiology, medications are often prescribed, prepared, administered, and recorded by a single individual, all while working in a complex and dynamic environment. Pediatric anesthesia has additional intricacies surrounding weight-based dosing, physiology, and pharmacodynamics. There are several measures to reduce the risk of medication errors in pediatric anesthesiology. Ensure accurate patient weight prior to procedures. Label all syringes and use standardized color-coded labels when possible. When administering medications, particularly very small volumes, ensure the IV line is flushed and that the medication does not stay in line. Provide a well-lit workspace and standardized organization of medication drawers. By promoting medication safety within individual systems, as well as nationally and internationally, providers can work towards providing even safer anesthetic care to the pediatric population.
For more information on patient safety, visit asahq.org/patientsafety22.
Well, Dr. Robertson, there's one final score that I did want to touch on,
sure.
And that's the Parents Postoperative Pain Measure, the PPPM.
Yes.
Go ahead and, if you don't mind, explaining to our listeners what this is and how it's used.
Sure. So this is for parents, their patients are having outpatient procedures. So it's a 15-item yes-no questionnaire. It can be completed by a parent or a caregiver and is designed specifically for use at home without the involvement of a healthcare professional. So a score of 6 or greater correlates with clinically significant pain and kind of tips the parent off to say, hey, yeah, my kid's in pain. I probably should go ahead and give that pain medicine now. It's actually been validated for children 2 to 12 years of age, and it's mainly used for research and quality improvement projects, but it's basically for outpatient basis. And a large majority of our cases are outpatient.
If our listeners want to go research this for themselves, figure out what they might like best to utilize, or just learn about these a little more in depth, where would you suggest they get this information?
A large majority of the information I gathered from textbooks. So from Dr. Cote's textbook, Cote's and Smith are, you know, obviously the two major textbooks. Both of them have all the pain scales actually listed in their entirety. And then give descriptions about each of them. So a good resource, as well as PubMed. It's fantastic. You just type in pediatric pain scales and you have numerous articles about how to choose which one to use.
Great. Well, let's talk about the importance of rating pain as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around for a little while, but historically that was not the case. So what considerations should we keep in mind as we use that tool for any of our patients?
Yeah, so several. Age is the biggest one, obviously. So if you have a kid that's less than three, they're more than likely they're not going to be able to adequately verbalize where it hurts, right? So this is where I think the pain scales really come into use and is in those situations. And then also you have to remember a lot of, especially in the academic setting, a lot of our patients are cognitively impaired. The developmental level is not what it could be because of comorbidities, or prematurity. Both children and adults who are cognitively impaired receive less pain medicine. It's been proven than the cognitively normal patient in a similar condition. So we want to make sure that we treat that pain just like any other patient that needs it. The self-reporting pain scales kind of complement the behavioral pain scales as well. And there's no inter-rater variability between the two. So if someone, you know, on the Wong-Baker FACES scale picks a three, that might correlate to a FLAC score of three. So it's helpful sometimes too to use both if you're not entirely sure where the patient stands.
What do you think as a clinician about using these scores along with clinical assessments rather than either or? I mean, we've all had patients that may indicate a pain level that doesn't seem to correspond to what they look like one way or the other. Either they look really comfortable and they say the pain score is a 10, or the other way, they look incredibly uncomfortable. Especially I've seen kids like this too, where incredibly uncomfortable, they look uncomfortable, but they're like, no, I'm a two. You know, and it looks like they're just trying their best. So there's a role for a combination of both clinical expertise and assessment and these scales.
Right. You can't use one or the other. You have to use, I mean, you don't have to use the pain scale necessarily, but I think it adds a lot to the clinical situation. I mean, again, taking it case by case, there have been lots of patients that I've had, though, that are like looking at their caregiver to tell them what they're supposed to be feeling. I get that a lot from, you know, some overbearing parents. Or parents that don't care as much, you know, about their child's pain. So you kind of have to take that into consideration too. If you've got a child that, you know, is brought up in a household that's like grin and bear it, you know, you're a big girl, that kind of thing, then they're going to probably be a lot less likely to act or to tell you that they're in pain than the average child. So you might want to go ahead and treat that even though they're telling you that they're not in that much pain.
Is it typical in pediatric patients that they underrate the pain?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that question because I come across both ends of the spectrum. You know, you have a slightly histrionic 15-year-old girl that's had scoliotic surgery and she's rating it a 10 out of 10, you know, and you're, you know, sitting here going, but your heart rate is 55 and your blood pressure is 110 over, you know, 70. So it's kind of hard to base it on just one generalization, I suppose.
Across the board, patients can be all over the spectrum.
Peds and adults.
Is there anything we need to know regarding peds chronic pain when coming to the operating room? Is there anything special the anesthesiologist needs to consider?
Yes. So for sure, if you have a kid, say for a sickle cell patient that comes in for a routine case, elective case or non-elective, you really want to know how much they are on at home at baseline. So if they, you know, they have a fentanyl patch or they take Narco or whatever. So you want to basically figure out how much they take on a daily basis and take that into consideration. They're definitely going to need more pain medicine than the normal child undergoing that same procedure.
Right. Again, highlighting the fact that every patient we treat is different. Needs their own anesthetic prescription, if you will.
Right. And also regional is a great way to go if you can, obviously based on the procedure itself for those chronic pain patients. So,
well, actually, let's talk about that just for a minute.
Okay,
this is a topic we could spend hours talking about.
Oh, yes.
Regional anesthesia.
Yes.
Talk about how that has evolved in pediatric pain.
Oh, my goodness.
It's so common in adults. As far as anesthesia is
concerned. Yes, no, it absolutely is. And of course, you know, we do a large majority of our blocks under anesthesia, under a general anesthetic, which can pose a lot of pluses, but also a lot of minuses. Doing neuroaxial lateral can be quite challenging sometimes in the bigger teenagers. But even just in the span of the amount of time I've been practicing, so I started residency in 2010, regional anesthesia in pediatrics has exploded. Like I just learned how to do PEX 2 blocks for bilateral breast reductions on our patients. They're fantastic. And the patients just absolutely are in zero pain, basically, when they get to the PACU if the procedure's done correctly. Also, TAP blocks have been amazingly wonderful. If you cannot do a neural axial anesthetic for, say, an XLAP for a patient, even for lap appies, we've been doing TAP blocks, and they, you know, come to the PACU and they basically express zero pain. So it's just a joy to be able to learn how to do these new techniques, and also for our patients to be so incredibly comfortable after these massive procedures that we do.
Well, a couple follow-up questions. Just again, this is a huge topic, and yeah, we could have our own specific show about this. But right, number one, how best, because I know there are programs out there where surgeons are very resistant to pediatric blocks. I think that prevalence is dropping, as you said, as you have stated, it's regional anesthesia in pediatrics has exploded. But what are a couple quick tips, if you have any, on how to get your surgeons on board or how to get buy-in?
Well, I feel like, you know, with our surgeons, we just have really good relationships. And I think it just starts there, basically. Good communication, good follow-up. So if you have, you know, if you've placed an epidural in a patient and you're going to check on them, you're making sure the adjuvant pain medication is ordered correctly, that you've talked to the parents, that they're well educated on what the regional does and does not provide. So we, you know, with epidurals, we'll say, you know, it takes away sharp pain, it doesn't take away dull pain. And at least if the patient doesn't understand that, at least the parent understands that. So they're not too, you know, excited about their child, you know, whimpering, but they're not like dying out crying, especially if they can't express, you know, what their pain level is. Also showing that it works, right? So if you do a couple, say, hey, you know, let me do this on this patient, these are the benefits, and just have them come to the PACU, have them come see their patient sitting up, you know, with a smile on their face, playing on their tablet, and not having any issues with pain after a larger surgery. It will convince pretty much any stubborn surgeon, I promise.
Comment a little bit about the follow-up once the blocks wear off.
So we actually have a sheet that we send home if this is an outpatient procedure and we've done, like, say, a popliteal block. I explain thoroughly, all of us do, to the parents and to the patient if they can understand what we're saying. Your block will wear off in X amount of time. This is the medication that we used. Please don't get behind on the pain. That's the biggest thing for me, is that I want them to make sure that they're, just because they don't feel anything right now, doesn't mean that they're not going to be, you know, the block's eventually going to wear off. So we're going to need to take some medicine before it starts wearing off. And usually if you're good about the communication and also have a follow-up phone call with them afterwards, they usually do really, really well.
No, exactly. And then finally, the one last question I want to ask you about this. If pediatric anesthesiologists want to learn blocks, let's say they have a practice that encompasses every case or every patient across the spectrum of pediatric anesthesia, are there a couple blocks or a few blocks they should focus on rather than try to learn every specific block that can be done now?
Well, there's so many that can be done now, and I'm still learning how to do some of these because they were not taught in my fellowship. But some of the main ones are same for the adults. So this may be different than some of the other children's hospitals in the country, but we do mainly blocks for lower extremity. So like femoral nerve, popliteal, adductor canal are the main ones. If you know how to do those really, really well, that will serve your patients quite fantastically, mainly for a lot of the ortho procedures. I utilize for the upper extremity a lot of supraclavicular, but not nearly as many as the lower extremity blocks. So if I had to focus on those, it would be the lower extremity ones.
Gotcha. Well, finally, is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the ACE issue?
Yes,
specifically.
So overall, I feel like that the audience of ACE actually gives really wonderful reviews. We have like a 99.9% approval rating about, you know, the questions that we pick. But one of the things we have gotten feedback on is that our questions need to be more relevant to everyday practice. So to the, you know, community anesthesiologist who's doing bread and butter cases all day, we have really taken that feedback to heart. And we're really trying to craft all of these questions that are like supremely clinically relevant. So you walk away from several hours from CME feeling like either you've brushed up on your knowledge that you know, or you've learned something new. So some of the questions that are asked in this specific issue, we have anything from the oxygen fail-safe valve ventilator question. We have several questions on TEE images that look really professional pictures and really drive home that knowledge. There's also a question about delirium and postoperative cognitive dysfunction that I knew nothing about. And I really enjoyed learning more about that because obviously that's on the far end of the age spectrum for me. And then also there's a question on K-Centra, so prothrombin complex concentrates, which we have actually several cardiac anesthesiologists on our board. So we kind of have to draw them away from writing those tough cardiac questions. But that one I knew very little about. And so I feel like the amount of knowledge that you are gaining and or brushing up on in these ACE booklets is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, the times I have utilized the ACE program, I've always found it very valuable. And so it's great to hear you talk about it. I appreciate all the time today in sharing your insights and your experience with the ACE question. It's been great talking with you, Dr. Robertson.
Great talking to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Stryker.
And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in again for this episode of Centraline. Please join us again next time and tell a friend if you like the episode. Take care.
Let industry partners pay for your education. Browse the latest grant-funded complimentary offerings at asahq.org/education. Subscribe to Centraline today, wherever you get your podcasts, or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.